The Guardian Football Weekly, sponsored by PES 2012. Released October 14th for PS3 and Xbox 360.
Clear the decks. This could be a biggie. Dateline Old Trafford, Man City side as ruthless as Balotelli's bathroom on fireworks night. Leave United blighted. And there's shocks and surprises elsewhere in the Premier League too, from Anfield to Bolton to Loftus Road, where two are sent off and neither is Joey Barton, in a historic day for the Arse as they leave Chelsea on theirs. The pod asks, is it true, as scientists suggest, that the Premier League has gone a bit mental? Elsewhere, there's foreign leagues' flimsy attempts to match the Prem for drama. Bundesliga have Bayern beaten. In the Liga, Barcelona scoring no goals. In Italy, Milan scoring some. We round it all up, throw in some terrific posts and tweets, and call it Football Weekly. Well then, indeed. Simon Burnton, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Simon. Raphael Honigstein, good morning.
Hello.
Hi. And Barry Glendening, good morning.
Why always me?
Yeah, why, Barry? Why?
Why not?
That's the best answer I've heard so far. We're going to talk about it then. The big game at Old Trafford. Was it a marker being laid down? Was it a freak result? Was it an accident waiting to happen?
I don't think it was a freak result. I think it was a freak score. City had 7 shots on target, scored 6. They didn't have any more shots on goal, say, than any other strong team, say, than Chelsea did. So it shows the benefits of hitting the target for a start, because quite a few players don't tend not to do that. But they were the vastly superior team, totally deserved to win, and it was very much a marker being thrown down.
They were the vastly superior team after the initial bit, which United dominated.
Yeah, they started very, very quickly and pinned them back, and the first 25 minutes or so you thought that City are really not in the game at all. Now they more or less scored with the first foray into the opposition half. I think their trick when it comes to the scoring was shooting from only 2 yards out every single time, which might explain why they only needed 6 shots on target or 7 on target. The interesting thing for me was, first I thought that City didn't look as if they needed Nasri or De Jong very much, which came as a surprise to me personally. And secondly, I tend to feel that the almost extreme rotation policy that's happened in United's central midfield over the last few weeks kind of just masks a real lack of authority and superstar quality in that middle. And it really affects the team both going forward, but also defensively. The back four look a lot more vulnerable than they probably have looked in many years. And there was a stat on Match of the Day 2 yesterday that in the last 5 home games at Old Trafford, they had 91 shots on De Gea's goal, which is a stat that probably a relegation-threatened side probably would be ashamed of.
You look at the total shots in the Premier League, home and away, Man United is by now well-known, conceding the most. The teams that are up there with them, Bolton, Norwich, Swansea, Wigan and Wolves. So, curious company for the champions. Simon Burnton. Now, it has happened many times in the past that United have been on the wrong end of a whomping, and they've regularly gone on to win the title despite that. In 99-2000 season, they got beaten 5-0 by Chelsea, went on to win the league. In the 2008-2009 season, they got beaten 4-1 by Liverpool, they went on to win the league. In the 96-97 season, they got beaten 5-0 by Newcastle, then the following week were beaten 6-3 by Southampton, and they still went on to win the league. I mean, I could go on.
Yeah, I think it's a good day to bet on United winning the league. The odds lengthened, but in part because of the ludicrous nature of the scoreline, which was distorted out of recognition by a final few minutes of utter mayhem. United were not as good as Manchester City yesterday, and they rightly lost the game. But while it pointed at deficiencies in their squad, I don't think that we're in any position to write them off yet.
All right, then. Aldershot next.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'll be looking forward to that.
I do think that
you don't care about the Carling Cup and Aldershot, do you?
I was really interested in the substitution of the bringing on Hernandez when United already seemed to have lost the game, and I thought that some kind of shoring up of their team was called for, and instead they brought on a striker who didn't really contribute much, and the absence of the player who might have been there in his stead was noticeable in those last 5 minutes.
So far we've talked more about United's deficiencies. What about City's efficiencies, as they're known? Mario Balotelli grabbing the headlines with those goals and the T-shirt. But David Silva.
David Silva was remarkable. He's probably the best player in the Premier League at the moment, and took no time to bed in at all. You know, as some people come from other leagues and takes them a while to get used to the pace, blah, blah, blah. But not him. He was remarkable, helped eviscerate United from all angles. And this was, it was kind of a victory for the little guy because the huge spendings, United, their back five is worth 81 million. Whereas the paupers of City, theirs was assembled for a mere 35 million.
All right, heartwarming stuff indeed, yeah. Who else should we pick out from City to lavish love upon?
Well, the players I thought were excellent were, as well as Silva, were Mika Richards and Mario Balotelli.
Hey, Mika Richards.
Mika Richards got man of the match.
Did he?
On TV. Yeah, I think you could have fairly given it to him, Balotelli or Silva.
Right. So. A lot of people getting excited about Gareth Barry.
The midfield of Silva, Yaya Toure and Barry just completely overran Fletcher and Anderson, who were made to look very ordinary indeed.
Mm. All right. Rafa.
Well, Milner, I think we should mention. Milner, yeah. I thought Milner was really outstanding. And
I probably meant Milner when I said Barry, actually. They're kind of interchangeable, aren't they?
Not
are
really.
They not? I think they are. I think of them as more or less the same player.
One actually can run, the other can't. So that's a huge difference.
Milner's the runner, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I've never been particularly impressed by Milner. He always seems more an athlete than an artist, and has never really inspired me. But I did think he had a really good game yesterday, a very athletic, dynamic. He was helped by Silva's magnificence, I suppose, that Silva tended to distract so many defenders that whoever ran beyond him found himself in space.
Yeah, and that man was often Mario Balotelli. Should we talk about him a bit just to conclude this bit of the chat? Some people would have seen him as a surprise inclusion in the team, perhaps, especially after his pyrotechnical end.
They were saying that on TV. Yeah. That Jamie Redknapp was absolutely bewildered that he could be included in the team after his domestic pyrotechnic display.
Mm.
If there are any people on the planet who haven't yet heard about what he did, him and some friends were setting off fireworks from his bathroom and sending them flying out the window, and some towels caught fire. Then the bathroom caught fire and the fire engine had to be called.
How seriously was the house damaged?
It's not gutted or anything. I think there was fire and smoke damage in one room.
Oh.
And Mario is currently residing in a hotel. He did rush back in to rescue a suitcase and a bag of cash that he didn't want to go up and smoke. So, but he wasn't hurt, thank God, and neither were any of his associates. And, you know, why shouldn't he have played?
Why shouldn't he fire fireworks from his bathroom and set fire to the...
Well, it's one of those things. It's like lighting a bonfire in your garden. Is it illegal?
No, it's not like lighting a bonfire in your garden at all.
Okay, it's like lighting a bonfire in your bathroom.
Yeah.
I have previous in the field of sports and pyrotechnics,
right.
But because I'm not sure of the statute of limitations on this, I may not go into the grisly details.
Right. But if you are an All Black who got hit by a firework at Lansdowne Road...
Samoan.
Oh, a Samoan. Yeah. Okay.
Who got hit by a firework at Lansdowne Road many, many years ago.
Yeah.
I
Barry's very sorry. Yeah. Well, the Italians are big on throwing fireworks from buildings. But anyway, there you go, horseplay.
Can you just expand on the Italians are big on throwing fireworks from buildings?
Well, they are. I mean, it's an issue. It's, you know, if you wander around Italian streets on New Year's Eve, famously, you have to watch out not only for objects being thrown down, you know, because they're all throwing stuff out tradition, but also, on New Year's Eve, I remember watching fireworks being fired on up in the Dolomites, and they weren't being fired in the sky; they were being fired at other buildings or just into the snow. It was quite playful, really.
Okay.
So, well, you know, clearly,
because I hadn't appreciated the kind of cultural history of firing fireworks from buildings.
Yeah.
I thought he was just a lone nutter, but in fact, he's just Italian.
Right. Indeed, he is. And the T-shirt, was that an ironic gesture? Was it, why am I always doing these things, or was it, why is everyone picking on me? What was our take on that?
A bit of both, I think. He did understand the value of irony after almost 2 years in England, and did understand that perhaps this was the closest he could come to admitting some sense of embarrassment and guilt, by at the same time sort of maintaining that the whole world is conspiring against him. I think it conveyed both messages quite eloquently at the same time.
It was genuinely laugh out loud funny, though. I think he made a lot of friends by showing off that T-shirt, as well as earning himself a yellow card.
Do you think that this season, this was Sean Ingle's contention this morning, he claims to have a big bank of data which supports this, which we declined to select. He suggests there are more freak results than usual this season. And he offered you know, in support of that argument, the 8-2 over Arsenal. I mean, this was a very different result to the 8-2.
You see, again, I think he's talking about freak scores rather than freak results. And last year we had a lot of freak results because the big teams, the sexy six, for want of a better word, were getting beaten on a regular basis. So,
right.
Yeah, there do
Fulham
seem to be a lot of...
Fulham 6-0 QPR, that was another one. Spurs 5-1 against City. Of course, 1-5 against City. Yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, the thing I thought was remarkable about yesterday was when Sir Alex Ferguson said afterwards that he would have preferred his team to just try and maintain a 3-1 defeat, which I thought was a remarkable thing for him to say. Yeah.
It was perhaps not the best week to claim that United have come closer to Barcelona, unless he meant in geographic terms, because they were in Romania, which is kind of...
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Nice one. All right, well, let's move on then. Having drawn what we can from that extraordinary... I mean, it was an amazing game, amazing thing to watch. But as was the game which followed it, the QPR-Chelsea match, for those who weren't out, you know, sourcing organic hummus in the West London area, a terrific 90 minutes at Loftus Road. And Barry, I have to say, it did look quite passionate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's passionate for those...
I think you owe them a little bit of an apology.
Well, someone made a comment on the blog taking what I said very, very seriously indeed, because, you know, that's what football fans do.
Well, you said you can't take this game seriously because people in West London are too busy off...
I said I couldn't take it seriously as a derby. For everyone involved, obviously they take it seriously. Yeah. But for, like, I've no connection to Manchester, but I can get caught up in the razzmatazz of a Manchester derby. West London derby or Fulham Chelsea just doesn't do it for me.
All right, well, watching it was hard not to get caught up. It was an extraordinary atmosphere there at Loftus Road, and amazing second half performance, ultimately fruitless by Chelsea with just 9 men. It would be easy to blame this all on David Luiz, so let's blame it all on David Luiz, no?
Not all of it. I mean, the penalty was really stupid.
And then Bosingwa getting sent off, that was his
fault. Yeah, that wasn't David Luiz. Was it?
It was his fault that Bosingwa was all on his own trying to cover this marauding
QPR. Yeah, but
QPR
you don't
player.
Have to pull him down, and you don't have to give a red card, in my view. I think you would have been... If he gives a yellow card, then we wouldn't even be talking about this. Nobody would say this had to be a red card. It was, you know, borderline.
I think while it would be churlish to be critical of QPR in this, their finest hour for many, many years, I'm going to be anyway. If I was a QPR fan, while being delighted that we'd beaten Chelsea, I would be very concerned about the fact that they were completely dominated by 9 men in the second half. Couldn't keep possession, just lumped the ball forward all the time. I don't know if that was a Warnock instruction or not. I suspect it may have been. And they were outpassed, and they had not a single shot in goal in the second half.
But you know what it's like. I mean, in German there's a nice phrase for this, is being afraid of your own courage. It's... When you feel you're winning, all of a sudden the fear of not winning overcomes you, and then you completely freeze up.
But the same thing happened to Swansea when they played Wolves on Saturday.
Yeah, more of which later. The emphasis on moron, I believe. Okay, very good. So Chelsea beat themselves largely with a bit of help from Chris Foy, according to Raphael, and certainly Andre Villas-Boas taking exception to the refereeing. But fact is,
every decision was absolutely at the very worst, justifiable.
Right.
And most of them were bang on correct.
You shouldn't give the referee the opportunity to make that call. Is that right? Something like that.
Well, I think that it is. It's the type of thing that Mourinho did as well, to go off on one against the referee after a defeat. And I think it kind of cheapens the whole thing. I mean, they had 2 men sent off for red card offences. They lost, though, and they had chances to draw. They could talk about the game. Don't just blame the referee. The referee had a fine match.
There you go.
But a lot of Chelsea players seem to lose their heads as well. John Terry in particular. Frank Lampard lost the plot as well. Luiz lost the plot, which didn't help the situation one bit. And I think the manager, rather than criticise the referee, should sort of look introspectively and think, what might he have done to stop them doing so?
The refereeing decisions aside, that Chelsea actually played really, really well with 2 men down, and I thought it was very, very impressive the way they bombarded QPR and didn't give up and perhaps should have scored. I think there is a kind of sense that they're coming back to, perhaps not to their best, but at least to sort of a level that you'd expect from them after indifferent start and after a bad end to last season. They look very strong.
All right then. Well, that's part one, but my word, there's plenty more where that came from as we look at some of the other surprising scorelines in a very eventful Premier League weekend a bit later on. For that, though, we're going to be talking to Sid and Ian from Raphael about the Bundesliga. part two, everybody. And here we go with Sid Lowe in Madrid. I'm guessing, Sid, is that correct?
That is correct, James. How are you?
All right. Yeah, very well. Very well. Listen, you've got a tough act to follow because we've just been describing a rip-roaring Sunday in the Premier League. How does the Liga weekend match up?
Well, can I just tell you what the league table says right now?
Tell me.
Top of the table, 8 games played, 6 victories, 2 draws, no defeats, only conceded 3 goals. Levante, Jimbo. Last week they were just behind Barcelona on goal difference. Now they're actually top of the table. And what I love about this is that on Saturday night, Real Madrid went top temporarily because Barcelona had drawn against Sevilla, of which more in a minute, I'm sure. And so the newspaper AS ran with a huge cover in big yellow letters. It says, leaders, Real Madrid top of the table temporarily. On Monday morning, Levante are top of the table for the first time in their 102-year history. So the front cover says, no, it doesn't. It says Cristiano Ronaldo scores lots of hat-tricks.
Scores lots of hat-tricks. 11 now.
11 he's scored 11. So far for Real Madrid, Cristiano Ronaldo.
All right, well, Levante then, let's give them some love. Let's give them our metaphorical cover. A 3-0 win over their neighbours, Villarreal.
Yeah, and what was so striking about this is I was talking about Levante this weekend, and a lot of people saying to me that you know, my desire to see romance in them because they've got absolutely no money, because it's a complete miracle that they're top of the table, because you look at the players and they shouldn't be there, is nonsense, because they're an ugly team who play dirty, who play very defensively, who are all kick and rush. And this weekend, that particular argument, at least in terms of this weekend's games, was completely blown out of the water, because they didn't just beat Villarreal, they destroyed Villarreal, and they play really, really nice football in patches. They're very, very quick on the break. They use the ball well. And Levante, as I say, a side that's only ever won one thing, which was the Copa de la República during the Spanish Civil War. So in other words, a cup in which most teams are not competing. And now they're top of the table. It's just brilliant. And I particularly love the comment, I think it was Juan Lu this morning, basically says, Ole nuestros huevos. In other words, say ole to our bollocks. Yeah, they certainly have a pair.
All right. That's fantastic. Moving on down the table then, Cristiano Ronaldo then scoring 3 as Real score 4 goals for the 4th time in a row. Is that right?
Yeah, every single game this season, Real Madrid have either scored 4, 6 or 0. So when they were 2-0 up, you knew there was at least 2 more goals coming.
That's remarkable, isn't it? And Ronaldo, this is 3 hat-tricks in how many games?
Three this season. It was Gonzalo Higuain who'd got 3 in 4 games before this. He opened the scoring.
Right.
Ronaldo, I think you're right in saying, I think it's 3 this season. It's,
that's amazing,
according to his cover this morning, 11 in total since he's been at Real Madrid. It really is amazing. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He is completely brilliant.
All right. Well, what about that other brilliant fellow in Barcelona then, Leo Messi? How many did he score this week, Sid?
Oh, well, this is the one, isn't it? Leo Messi is actually big front page headline. It says, Messi is human. This is Barcelona against Sevilla. It's 0-0. It's the 90th minute plus 49 seconds. Andres Iniesta is brought down in the penalty area. Can debate whether or not it is a penalty. I've seen it 2 or 3 times. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it probably is. The Sevilla players run to the linesman, who says to them, what do you want to talk to me for? I didn't see it. I didn't blow it. Nothing to do with me. Sent them back to the referee. Messi is standing by the penalty spot. Canute comes over and kicks the ball away from the spot. Only a few yards, but just enough to wind them up. Then that court turns into a big, big fight. Everyone's fighting. And this is the image that I love about it. Everyone's pushing and shoving and going crazy. And Leo Messi is just standing there all on his own on the penalty spot with the ball in his hand, forced to wait 4 minutes to take the penalty. Now, if that doesn't seem very long, when people listen to us, maybe they should stop watching.
Probably does seem quite long when they're listening to us.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's even longer when you're not listening to us. It's a hell of a long time. So he's then eventually gets to take this penalty in the 90th minute plus 4 minutes and 49 seconds. And Javi Baras, the Sevilla goalkeeper, who's only really become first choice this year, despite the fact he's 29 now, had been brilliant all game. I think Barcelona had 21 shots at this stage. He'd made 6 really, really good saves, really difficult ones, chances that Barcelona should have scored. Varas against Messi in the 95th minute at the Camp Nou, 0-0. Barcelona are trying to, you know, take away Sevilla's unbeaten record. And Varas saves it. It was just brilliant moment, because he'd had such a good game. But I mean, I know this is ridiculous and it doesn't work like this, but it would have been a bit unfair had he not saved it.
Sid, guy on Twitter called The Neil Thing has asked me to ask you about the TV presenter of the footy show La Sexta, on which you're a pundit, apparently, who interrupts shows to advertise razors. And I don't know what exactly he wants me to ask. He presumably, is your punditry so bad that your colleague's providing a service for viewers who feel compelled to open a wrist while listening to it?
Yeah, it's the sort of Sunday afternoon roundup show in Spain, and I only do a small section of it. But I came onto the set to see one of the other presenters sitting there with a razor in front of him. What's that all about? And I must admit, I wasn't on set when it actually happened. But in program advertising is very, very common in Spain, so you will have kind of a break off during the program. So it's effectively product placement rather than advertising in terms of going to an ad break. And I haven't seen it, but I think there was some sort of advert for some razor company or other.
But that's very disappointing to see that kind of thing coming in. In other news, to celebrate the release of Pro Evolution Soccer 2012 on the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, the people at Konami have given us a very special prize. The chance for one lucky Football Weekly listener to take themselves and a friend to Madrid to see Real at the Bernabeu, flights and accommodation included, only available to UK residents. They are, though, even throwing in a couple of copies of Pro Evolution Soccer 2012 as well. To enter, you have to answer the following question. Which international title did Real Madrid win in 1952 and 1956, becoming and remaining the only European side to win the tournament twice? Details and a link to the entry form are on the Football Weekly webpage. The competition closes next Wednesday, the 26th of October. Sid, we'd love to hear more about the Liga, but we're not going to.
Why not?
Well, I don't know. Is there anything else you need to tell us?
No, you're probably right, actually.
All right, great. Fantastic. All right, well, listen, enjoy yourself, and we'll catch up with you later in the week, perhaps.
Brilliant. Speak to you on Thursday.
Thanks, Sid.
Oh, Levante.
Yeah, Levante. That's a tough act for the Bundesliga to follow then, isn't it, Rafael?
Almost impossible, because Bayern are still number one, but right. The gap has closed to only 3 points.
Well, this is after this amazing 2-1 defeat by Hannover, which saw, am I right, Bayern conceding the first Bundesliga goal in more than 12 hours of football?
770 minutes, I think it was, yes. Quite remarkable, and a remarkable game, because Hannover are probably the most tactically astute side in the Bundesliga, the way they set up. They defend really smartly and then break with unbelievable precision and efficiency. You'd almost think they're just German or something. They're really very, very good.
Right.
And Bayern kind of fell into their trap a little bit. They committed a silly mistake, Philipp Lahm in the box, to give away the penalty that finally beat Neuer's record or attempted record. Abdelauer scored, and then Boateng was very stupidly sent off. Bayern just kept on going, conceded a really freaky second goal. Shot was deflected, spun over the keeper, Neuer into the net, and they came back at the very end to only score that one goal from Alaba, the substitute. But the problem, I think, is more that Heinkes has not rotated the squad at all in recent weeks, at least the front four. And they're all running on empty a little bit. Gomez looked very, very short again, missed a couple of really good chances. Müller looks like he shouldn't be on the pitch. Ribéry was okay, but mostly crowded out, isolated, because there's no Robin on the other side to take a bit of the load off him. So overall, not a great performance. Although Jupp Heynckes, the manager, said that, even if they'd won 5 or 7-0, he wouldn't be as happy with the team's performance. I think...
Why?
He was trying to make the point that despite losing and one man down, the team did everything, etc. Okay. But they really... Again, they beat themselves. And it's becoming quite ironic, because a few weeks ago, when they looked unbeatable, both Philipp Lahm and Bastian Schweinsteiger said, we can only beat ourselves. But they have effectively been beating themselves.
Right.
Both when it came to the 1-1 draw.
It's not a good idea for sportsmen. Is this before matches? Is that why they're performing so badly?
Possibly. And again, it was largely self-inflicted. Dortmund, though,
were dear
quite
Cologne.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, dear Cologne. No, all right. 5-0 anyway. Now, how is it the Borussia Dortmund are terrific? They were the champions last year, as you know, and they're clearly back in form here in the Bundesliga. But in the Champions League, they've been rotten. Why?
Yeah, they were terrible. I mean, the 5-0 needs to be explained as a reaction to the terrible Olympiacos result, because they really went for it and they were intent on annihilating Cologne.
But they got beaten by, Marseille 3-0 as well?
Yeah, I think it's largely down to couple of things. Probably you can nail it down to two factors. One is the incredible inexperience that is still being shown up at that level. Against Olympiacos, the average age was 22, and that included a 31-year-old goalkeeper. Ooh. So, you know, none of these players have actually played in the Champions League at all. And against teams who are not as talented, but a little bit more street smart, shall we say, and know how to intimidate the opposition and to get the better refereeing decisions, they've been shown up as being a little bit naive, especially when it comes to the defending. And the other thing that ties into that is perhaps the loss of Nuri Sahin, who's moved to Real Madrid, is still injured, has been underestimated, because he is the kind of player that, for all his brilliance, can be very low-key, because he doesn't do anything spectacular. But what he does do, a little bit like Didi Hamann, perhaps at his heyday, is he keeps everything going and everything together. And without him protecting the back four, they're a lot more exposed and they make a lot more mistakes than they did last year.
All right, then. Interesting. Serie A, speaking of interesting, what a game that was at the Stadio Via del Mare in Lecce. Milan 3-0 down to Little Lecce and then winning 4-3. Did you see this one, Barry?
No.
But you heard about it, though, didn't you?
Well, I heard about it from you.
Oh.
Earlier today. Apparently, you said it was a rather odd game.
It was a very peculiar and perplexing game.
You suggested...
I didn't suggest anything about the game at
you
all.
You suggested there may be an election coming up since...
Now, the first half, I was thinking, well, Berlusconi must have some candidate standing in local elections, because Milan were absolutely abject. They just stood around and watched as the Lecce breeze passed them, cheered on by this kind of... summer holiday type crowd. It was a balmy afternoon down in Lecce, and the crowd was a sparse crowd at the Stadio Via del Mare, and the players just kind of happily scampered past and got themselves into a 3-0 lead. And then, duly in the second half, stood around and left Cassano and Boateng repeatedly unmarked until Milan had managed to make their way to a 4-3 win, which was absolutely extraordinary. One of the biggest turnarounds in Serie A of, well, certainly this century. And fantastic stuff, which means that Milan are now, what are they? They've gone back to 5 points, 4 points rather, off the top of the table. Big glut of teams at the top. You've got Udinese are top. Now, they're at Napoli on Wednesday night, who are fifth. Then Lazio, then Juventus, then Cagliari, bizarrely. Then Napoli, Roma and Milan, who are all 4 points off the top. Also coming up, Juve taking on Fiorentina on Tuesday night, a midweek special round, and Juve were in a 2-2 draw, Fiorentina were in a 2-2 draw. Inter, should just mention, they got a win at home to Chievo. This was special because they scored a goal at the San Siro for the first time in Serie A this season. It gives you an indication of how badly they've been doing. Post, Brendog says, what was the name of the restaurant in Rome? We were talking about pizzerias last week, Raphael. I bet you've got something to add here. Little something to bring to the table. We did mention Fior Fiori as a kind of takeaway slabs of pizza al taglio thing, which is in Via Vittoria. But and I think I also mentioned La Maremma, and Sid mentioned Pizza Ray, which is a bit of a chain thing. But a question for the keeper says, on the pizza question, I live in Rome, and if you're sticking to Fior Fiori on Via della Croce, he's absolutely right, or Pizza Ray, you're really missing out. Now, he suggests going to Dar Poeta, or Beer and Food in Trastevere, La Gatta Mangiona in Monteverde, and Pizzarium near Cipro metro station are among the best. Sid, if you're still listening, by the way, the best pizza in Madrid is La Cupola in Las Matas. So there you go, people. Rafael, what's your favourite pizza in London?
Saracino.
Oh, OK, interesting. Yeah, you talked about that before. I like Red Pepper myself. If you're in West London, Red Pepper's my tip. Barry, people tweeting and suggesting that you get down to Franco in Manca, or Franco Manca.
In Brixton.
Yeah.
I've been there. I'm not a big fan of pizza. Myself, Sean Ingle and Mrs. Ingle and Ingle Jr. were there one Saturday for lunch.
Right.
And it's good pizza, but I'm not a pizza guy.
I thought pizza was an absolute good. I didn't think you could like it or not like it.
I will eat it if there's no alternative, but it would never be my repast of choice.
Really? Simon, how do you feel about that?
I've, like you, never met someone. I've never met someone who says, blanket, pizza not for me.
All
never.
Right. Okay. On a less relevant note, Brillig, 1976, says, I was wondering if you could possibly muse on the travails of Birmingham City in your next pod. Our games are all out of kilter with everyone else's, so we tend not to get a mention, but we're generally dealing with a horrendous Thursday to Sunday fixture list quite well with a thin, cheap, but well-put-together in-adversity squad. The game against Bruges was one of raucous legend, and despite relegation, I think almost all Birmingham fans would take this rollercoaster ride of a trudging drudgery in the Premier League under McLeish. Houghton has done very well. And, of course, they followed up that post with a terrific 2-0 win away to Bristol City. Well done.
Well, I mean, being in the Premier League isn't a be-all and end-all of life at all.
Well, it's to be fair, it's often the end-all. where particularly if you're struggling for smaller clubs, obviously Norwich are doing fine at the moment, Swansea, QPR, and they're having a nice time, and good luck to them. But quite often, small clubs go up. The Premier League can be a remorselessly miserable experience.
Mm.
And the Championship, I think that it's not a great season in the Championship this year. There seems to have been a bit of a downturn in quality, despite the arrival of Brighton and Southampton, who are both strong teams. But it's a lot more fun. You can win. And you can win by decent scorelines. I mean, a team that spent a few seasons struggling in the Premier League will have gone that time without very often winning 3-0 or 4-0 without being able to enjoy the last half hour of a match, knowing that they're going to win it. And those are pleasant experiences.
Mm, certainly are. Very nice. And Birmingham City then?
Well, they're doing all right. They're mid-table for now.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people were predicting calamity at the start of the season, and I don't think that's going to happen.
All right. That's it for part two then. Very, very shortly, we'll tackle some of the remaining questions from that Premier League weekend. Well, countless stories that would have been front page material this weekend were it not for the extraordinary events at Old Trafford. Of course, Chelsea losing to QPR was one of them. But also, how about Liverpool drawing with Norwich? Norwich is power, eh? As the old saying goes, Barry.
Yeah, that was a remarkable game. Liverpool probably should have been about 4-0 up after 20 minutes. They weren't. They eventually went 1-0 up. Luis Suarez had...
11 chances.
He managed to play quite well and really badly at the same time. He ran down a lot of blind alleys and lost possession. He had numerous chances to score.
11, apparently.
Possibly could have had 5 or 6 goals.
It's not the first time this has happened.
Well, one of the Sachin who works downstairs was making the point yesterday that while Suarez is a very good player, he's incredibly profligate in front of goals and misses a hell of a lot of chances. His conversion rate per chances made is very, very poor. And that certainly showed on Saturday in a game Liverpool should have won comfortably, ended up drawing and could have lost.
Mm.
So Norwich were lucky, but you know they earned their luck. And Super Grant Holt scored a fine equaliser and possibly should have had a winner as well.
No, as the commentator was suggesting, you'd rather have Grant Holt meeting your cross with his noggin than Andy Carroll.
Well, Andy Carroll missed a glorious opportunity to win it for Liverpool towards the end. Loads of goal to aim at, sort of leaning back, header, and somehow put it wide.
In other weekend Premier League news, the Fulham game, where it looked like they were set to win and ended up losing 3-1 to Everton.
Yeah, it was quite an extraordinary game in its own right. Some spectacular goals scored, and a truly mind-boggling miss from Bobby Tomori in the 89th minute that, to my mind, it beat Fernando Torres and rises to miss of
really?
The season so far.
Really? Why?
He did nicely to take the ball around the keeper, just as Torres did at Old Trafford. But where Torres was off balance and was shooting back across himself, he just had to side-foot the ball into the net. It was as straightforward a chance as you could possibly hope to get.
And from the resulting goal kick, Everton went down the other end, scored, and then scored again.
Yeah, indeed. 3-1. And the further misfortune for Fulham was that they were ordered to take off a defender who had been bleeding, and his replacement, the first thing he did was get beaten by Saha for Everton's second goal. Yeah,
speaking of fans being comforted by their manager making a change which brings the game back in their favour, how about those cheery Wolves fans then? Extraordinary match against Swansea. The visitors who hadn't... had they even scored a goal away from home? I think they'd had one or something, hadn't they, so far, Swansea? They'd scored a goal at Norwich, but they hadn't got a point away from home yet, and they went to play Wolves, and they were 2-0 up, and then what happened, Barry?
Well, Wolves fans were on their teams back from very early on and booed them throughout most of the first half, booed them off at half time. And then in the second half, Mick McCarthy, who was getting visibly fed up with the abuse he was getting and his team was getting, he brought off Matt Jarvis and Adam Hamill, brought on Gudero and Milijas, so it would, you know, wouldn't have taken off two wingers. Seemed a bit odd, and he got roundly booed for that. Now, the substitutions worked in so much as Wolves went on to score two goals and equalise. I think that might have been more through Swansea's shortcomings than any tactical brilliance on Mick McCarthy's part. But then at the end, Wolves fans were celebrating as if they'd won the game. And I sort of, while watching the match, I went on Twitter and I was sort of, why on earth, what is the point of booing your own team? And Carl Henry in particular, who's not the world's greatest footballer by any stretch of the imagination, but he can never really be faulted for effort. They've singled him out for particular amounts of abuse. And I just don't see what it achieves. People on Twitter, I got the usual moron saying, you know, oh, you pay your money, we can do what we want. And which is not true. If you pay your money, it entitles you to watch a football match. If you want to boo, there's no one, you know, you can't be stopped. But I really don't see how it can help a team whose confidence is already rock bottom. You know, I think a team, if they're 2-0 down at home to Swansea, they know they're playing badly. They know the fans aren't happy. They don't need to be told.
I mean, I'm with you to a certain extent, but as a point of principle, if it's okay to boo a manager who's putting a lot of effort in but is useless, wouldn't it be okay to boo a player who's putting a lot of effort in but is useless at his job?
But is it okay to... I don't think Mick McCarthy is useless. I don't think Carl Henry is
useless.
No,
just generally
useless.
Speaking, if you know their fans want to get rid of a certain manager like Steve Keane, for example, they think he's not up to the job.
They didn't boo him, though. It was interesting. They actually supported the team and then just held the sheets up saying Norway says no to Keane at the end of the match. Isn't the time for booing when you think the players aren't putting effort in and then
yeah,
they do
that,
want to?
That's understandable if a player isn't trying.
Have you ever booed, or do you just
never,
throw
no.
fireworks? That
I would sulk rather than boo. I've never booed a team I've been supporting or any player on a team I've been supporting.
Right, okay. Raphael, you ever booed?
I certainly have, yeah.
Have you? Who have you booed?
Well, I can't say.
Tell me. No. Well, the team that you support?
Yes.
And why? What have they done that deserve your booing?
They were just awful.
All right, and you felt that booing them would make them better?
No, but I felt that I needed the release.
Right, fair enough. Yep, that's all the explanation I regret. Simon, I bet you've never booed anyone. You're a lovely chap.
I tend to really concentrate on matches when I go, even as a fan. I tend to find that vocalising, even talking to the bloke next to me, just distracts me from watching the football. And so I don't tend to vocalise it.
That's interesting. I have the opposite thing. If I don't talk to somebody about the game, then I just drift off and start watching something. I don't know. If I'm at the game, I'm watching the wrong end of the stadium. And if I'm watching on TV, then I, you know.
I think... To make a serious point, I think it really also depends on the team, not just on its capabilities, but also on its makeup. Because there are certain teams that you feel that they could actually do with some metaphorical kick up the backside, whether it's from the manager at half time or from the crowd. Whereas there are other teams who you feel if you start the moment you start booing, that will fall apart and you know, show up their fragile, haunted souls.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't watch Wolves enough to tell you which category they would fall into. But certainly the team that I supported and booed back in the 80s would be in the first camp.
But I also think that booing is one thing, and booing is just like, it just says, I'm displeased, I'm unhappy.
Right.
But to chant, you don't know what you're doing. It doesn't really take into account the fact that Mick McCarthy has actually done pretty well at Wolves over the period he's been there. Mm. And that what they should be saying was, you've done pretty well, but at the moment we're a little bit disenchanted.
Right.
It just doesn't rhyme.
It doesn't scan so well. But what they need to do is actually come up with a bespoke chant that fits the situation.
Lazy chanting.
Boo Mick McCarthy. I think that's appropriate. But to say that he doesn't know what he's doing is perhaps a little harsh on the lad.
Did you see the poor lass in tears after Swansea's second goal?
I did. I thought that was...
Koala head.
I mean, I have to say that football fans crying is something that I like.
Okay.
But, like, I mean, in recent months we've had situations where fans are booing off teams that aren't even losing.
Yes.
Arsenal booed off after a friendly they didn't lose. And you just go, it's extraordinary. I don't know if it's because of this new breed of very difficult to please fan, or maybe I'm just far too tolerant of my old age.
Arsenal, was there not something to do with the ticket prices at the same time? It was the start of the new season which had seen ticket prices hiked, and that was the spectacle they were now paying more for. Chelsea being booed at half-time earlier this season at Stamford Bridge, no?
Well, someone was trying to say to me on Twitter that was only like 40 or 50 people out of 40,000. I go, but they must have been mic'd up then because it was very, very loud.
But there is perhaps a correlation between the amount you charge and what people expect to receive in return.
Mm-hmm.
When ticket prices were pretty cheap, compared to people's wages. They would. It was a social event. You'd go with your whole family and you'd see the same people and you'd watch some football and the football would happen around you and you'd have a nice day. But if you're spending £35 or £45 on the match, you want it to be a damn good display of footballing excellence. Mm. And if that's not what you receive, then you're unhappy.
Don't go and watch Wolves.
Right. Interesting. Especially because there are so many other teams in the region. One of whom, West Brom, are offering all sorts of success for people who follow them. They've just had their second derby win in a row. They beat Wolves and now they've gone and beaten Villa as well. Some very perplexing refereeing in this game. This was the game...
You're referring to the Alan Hutton challenge.
Alan Hutton taking out Shane Long, which means all sorts of problems for the Republic of Ireland in their upcoming fixture in Estonia. Hutton didn't get anything for that, or did he get a yellow? I'm not sure.
No, he didn't even get penalised.
He was a bit later on for much less.
Right, OK, but the referee did give a penalty for something completely inconsequential in you know...
The linesman gave the penalty.
Oh, the linesman gave it. And then he booked Shana for showing the T-shirt his kids had made for him, and that's so wrong.
People complain about players being put for celebrating with the fans, and I have to say I'm behind that being a bookable offence. But I don't see, I don't understand why people get booked for showing T-shirts. Perhaps in some cultures, a naked man chest is frowned upon.
But this wasn't.
But no.
You see, you're not actually booked for showing a T-shirt. You're booked for removing your shirt or pulling it over your head. And apparently, it stems from a Confederations Cup tournament.
Oh.
Some years ago when it just reached endemic proportions and players were removing, entire teams were removing their shirts at the drop of a hat, so FIFA decided to do something.
Because there used to be very much a sponsorship issue to this. People used to take off their shirt and show their sponsor shirt underneath. In the Rome Derby last week, of course, Osvaldo unveiled a T-shirt saying, "I've been your laxative. I have also been your laxative." This referred back to a very famous T-shirt that Francesco Totti wore years ago in the derby, which said, "I've been your laxative," which is a strange thing to say.
Lost in translation? Maybe?
Well, lost in translation. It suggests that I've really made your bowels open. Again, I've purged you.
Is that a good thing?
The direct translation is, "I have purged you." Yeah. I've given you the, you know, I've made your bowel.
So Francesco Totti was basically comparing himself to a caffeine enema.
Similar, yeah. Mm. Anyway, and Osvaldo naturally liked the sound of that. So when he scored in the opening goal in the derby a week ago, he unveiled a T-shirt saying, "I have also been like a coffee enema."
My all-time favourite shirt revelation booking was the bloke a few years ago who pulled off his kit to reveal an identical kit underneath and was still booked.
Yeah. Balotelli's this week is, I think, right up there, isn't it? Why always me? Should we finish off while saluting West Brom, who certainly seem to have sorted themselves out very nicely, with a quick mention for your team there, Sunderland, and ask, what does this mean for Bolton now? After their brief return to winning ways last weekend against Wigan, they've now lost their sixth match in seven. Even Sunderland beat them.
Well, it means they're third for bottom. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Wigan and Blackburn both lost as well is obviously helpful to them. And Fulham and Wolves not winning and Swansea not. Anyway, yeah. It's a good weekend for Sunderland down at the bottom.
Right.
Because the teams around them didn't do very well.
All right. But Bolton, we thought it was just all that early season tricky fixture business, but it seems there's something a bit more serious than that.
Well, the goals were very late. So Nicholas Bentner was wearing an interesting, arresting pair of lime green boots, which sort of had me worried. But he came good in his lime green boots and scored a goal. So.
Good.
Stefan Sessegnon, who I've been keeping an eye on since choosing him in my fantasy league team.
All right.
Pre-season. He had a very good pre-season and Sunderland were playing him up front. Just before he scored the opening goal, the ball comes in from the corner. It's coming right onto his head and he's being marked by Paul Robinson, who's quite physical but not very tall. And the ball eventually drops about a yard from where he was originally standing. And he doesn't move and he looks away from the ball. I found it a really puzzling bit of play, just that immediately preceding his goal. Paul Robinson then heads the ball really badly. The ball's sent back in, and Sessegnon, this time it's on the ground. He's more interested. I don't know if he's got an issue with headers. Swivels and tucks it home. But I don't know what he's doing in the penalty area contesting a set piece, if that's how he reacts to one that is dropping pretty much perfectly onto his forehead.
That's a very good question, sir. I don't have any answer to that at all. Well, we can't end Football Weekly on that cliffhanger. So let's have our obligatory reference to Arsenal. Raphael, surprise us with a stat.
They've won 6 and 7 of the last games in all competitions.
That's amazing. And yet...
The crisis is over.
But only when Van Persie's playing.
Yes, and that's why he's not playing that much, because he's very fragile and needs to be rested. That's why he didn't start. But it was worrying. On the one hand, Arsenal fans are happy because they're picking up wins again and climbing up steadily up the table. On the other hand, the one-man team of yesteryear, if you talk about maybe Fabregas or Nasri, has turned into the Van Persie team. And that's a big worry.
All right, then. That's it, then. Carling Cup awaits midweek. And we'll be back on Thursday. So do join us then. In the meantime, many thanks to guest producer Phil, to Barry, to Raphael, and to Simon Burton. And have a super week.
The Guardian Football Weekly, sponsored by PES 2012. Forever evolving, forever football, forever Pro Evo.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.